Let me get my trusty post-it note for all the times I have to edit crap out.
You've only got one?
Yeah, I write really tiny. Hi everyone, welcome to the PC Perspective Podcast. This is episode number 39 for October 17th, 2008. I'm Ryan Schraub.
I'm Jeremy Hellstrom.
And I'm Josh Walren.
And this is the official podcast for PC Perspective website at pcper.com. We go through the last couple of weeks' worth of technology news and any articles, interesting articles that we've written on the site or just interesting technological tidbits that have occurred with us that we think might be of interest to you. I think, actually, that's kind of where I want to start. This is stuff that's been bugging me and interesting me in the last couple days. Figured I'd get Jeremy and Josh's opinion on here, and if anybody wants to write in and let me know. So one of the side projects that you may or may not know of that's coming to PC Perspective is video content. You may also know that this has been an ongoing project for quite some time. As everything I seem to do, it takes a long, long time. But I think for good reason, trying to do things professionally, you know, as high quality as I can and as professional looking as I can, even if it doesn't turn out that way. I want to at least try. So in the process of this, I've been putting a computer in the basement for video editing and putting up lights and all this other nonsense. It's not very interesting to people. But one of the issues I came across was I have no Ethernet in my basement. It's an unfinished basement. I don't have any cables run down there yet for anything except a couple of electrical outlets. So I started doing the planning of, well, how am I going to get Ethernet cables from my office where my router is up into the attic, and then I got to try to find an interior wall to drill down through so I don't have to worry about insulation. So I can get all the way to the basement, but then I'm going to have to cut holes in drywall on each floor in order to drill a hole through the floorboards to continue on to the next level. So it was a big project. It sounded like it was going to be a big pain in the butt. And then about 2:30 last night in the morning, I had an epiphany of sorts. And I thought, hey, I remember hearing about power line networking. Have either of you ever played with it before?
Read about it. Haven't played with it yet.
Same with me.
Okay. Well, that was about the same deal I was in. So I tried to do some research online. And first caveat, make sure you check the dates on the articles that you read.
Oh, it's been about 5 years that they've sort of had it.
Yeah. Well, I found the first result on Google, I just typed in Powerline Networking, was an article on howstuffworks.com, and I really like that site. They usually have pretty interesting information, pretty accurate. So I went through and I started reading it, and they kept mentioning all these caveats, like limited to 14 megabits in most iterations. It only works on Windows because it requires a driver. And here's the kicker. They said it connects to your computer through a parallel port. And I went, wait a minute. I don't even think I have a parallel port on my computer anymore. And I'm willing to bet there are a lot of people like that. So I actually couldn't find a date on the article. So I looked up Wikipedia and all this other kind of stuff. And it turns out the technology has actually been getting a lot better in, say, the last 2 years. I found at Best Buy for $150 a Linksys kit with two adapters, one that goes near your router, one that goes to where you want network to be. And it actually does 100 megabit, up to 100 megabit network connections, which is actually pretty good. And the installation was incredibly simple. Here's a box that looks like a little miniaturized hub. You plug the power cord into the wall. You plug the network cable into the back of the box and the other end of the network cable into the back of the router. Go to where you need internet but don't have any. Take the exact same looking box, plug the cord into the wall, plug network cable into the back of the box, one network cable into the back of your computer. So it's still using, you know, your standard Ethernet ports and all that kind of stuff. Turn on the computer, bam, worked just like it was connected with an Ethernet cable, found the router, got its IP address, was online, no problems. So the only issue I ran into, actually, was you cannot plug it into a surge protector. Yeah, it has to go directly into the wall. I'm actually using an extension cord in the basement, and it works fine. But if you put a surge protector between it and the wall, it doesn't seem to find each other. So,
does the router-looking box act as a surge protector if you got any spikes coming through?
It says it has its own internal surge protection. So
it's got a fuse.
Probably. But I was pleasantly surprised by how easy it was. I haven't benchmarked it or anything specifically yet. I was able to get at least 20 megabits out of it because I did a speed test on my ISP and it pulled about 20 megabits. So that, it's reasonably fast. I would prefer to have gigabit down there, and I may still do that eventually. But for kind of a Band-Aid fix, it was surprisingly easy to do, and I could see this being very, very helpful for people that don't want wireless because it's of how unreliable it is, or they want faster than their 802.11b that they have, and that kind of stuff. For instance, if you have a networked DVR or Blu-ray machine or your video game consoles, if you don't, most people don't have Ethernet run across their house, so you buy this device, plug it in behind your your entertainment center area, and you could plug this Linksys one. Actually, the one of the routery type bits or whatever, the transmitter of it, has 4 Ethernet ports on it, so you can connect 4 devices right up to it without even having to buy an external switch and that kind of deal. So turned out to be pretty neat and worked well, and you really can't say that about a whole lot of technology all the time.
Well, I'm rather curious. Why don't you get a drill and a 12-inch bit that's half-inch wide and go into a corner of your office and just drill through there?
Well, because then I would be on the first floor.
Oh, you're...
My office is on the second floor.
And I did not know this.
I was going to the basement.
Well, that makes things a little bit more...
I mean, it was completely doable to run Cat 5, and it's still something I'm probably going to have to do, but want to do eventually anyway. But for wanting to get the computer running and on the network today, I mean, no substitute. Wireless wasn't working down in the basement, so this worked out pretty well. I don't know a whole lot about how it actually works, how it transmits over the power line. I did read some stuff about possible interference when you're running devices that use a lot of varying current, perhaps. But we'll all have to see how it goes. For day one, I'm impressed. So, something to look into if you have that issue.
I'm happy for you.
I'm excited.
Well, good.
Well, I was going to talk about Slingbox and Slingcatcher. I don't know if either of you guys know of these things or are interested in them. I just wanted to talk about it because it was something I was looking at buying. It was one of these Slingbox Pro HDs. Basically, it let you hook it up to your DVR, TiVo, whatever's attached to your TV, your primary TV, and then you hook it up to your wired network, which is another good place to use this power line networking if you don't have network near your home theater. And then you can watch any TV, either that you had recorded or that's live on any computer, either in your network or on the internet or even on your BlackBerry. There's an application for your BlackBerry you can buy that will stream it to your BlackBerry. Hopefully they'll have one for the iPhone, this kind of stuff. So for somebody, again, this comes down to me wanting to work in the basement but not wanting to run coaxial cable to get a cable box down there and not really wanting to pay to get another cable box either. If I were to put one of these devices on my TV upstairs, I could just watch TV on my computer. And it actually has IR blasters that you actually control the DVR box and all this kind of stuff. So it's a lot more analog than it might seem at first as far as how it actually functions. But it sounds interesting. I guess this is something that's been around for a while. It might be a little late to the party. But
Yeah, I know some folks who are interested in that. They're actually overseas and get to miss a lot of the programming in the United States. And right. So they're buying that for their parents and hooking that up to their DVR and whatnot. And, when they get a chance, then they use a Sling Box to watch their favorite shows that they can't see right now on, whether they're over in Korea or Japan or wherever.
Yeah,
they're overseas and they're watching their home TV.
Right, and that's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And then the Sling Catcher is kind of the opposite device. This you actually connect to a TV, and then it can receive any video, any TV over the Sling Box that you might have, as well as it says that it'll play YouTube, it'll play any of the online video sites and that kind of stuff. So it's kind of like an Apple TV replacement, but also has support in it for your Sling Box. So, if I had a TV downstairs in my basement but didn't want to run coax down there, I could buy a Sling Catcher, hook it up to it, and then I could watch TV through the TV upstairs, so to speak.
Yep.
Or anywhere for that matter. So there you go. Interesting device. Check it out. If I get one, obviously I'll have to post up some thoughts, etc. All right, let's move on to maybe a little bit more hardware-based discussion, stuff that people might have been expecting to hear from us. I'm curious, I don't really remember how much we talked about the barrage of budget graphics cards last week. I know we did discuss them a little bit, but I don't think I had done a whole lot of actual testing on them. I think we talked about the 4670 because the review of that went up the very next day after the podcast.
Yeah. Well, it's a topic worth covering. We've never seen a market like this on the lower end.
No, it's very...
Well, we've never seen the market like this from low end to top end, to tell you the
also
truth.
Also true. With the top end still being affordable and not over a grand.
Yeah.
Exactly. I guess the most... We talked about the Radeon 4670... And then NVIDIA's kind of, their response to that. And I guess it's important to note that NVIDIA hasn't really been releasing any new products for this. Is that fair to say?
I think that's absolutely very fair to say.
So AMD has been releasing new products based on their RV770 design, but, 730, 710, those kinds of derivatives. And NVIDIA instead has been taking existing products, maybe tweaking them a little bit and then lowering the prices in order to get competitive with it. So I just finished testing and am in the process of writing up after we record this a review of the Radeon HD 4550 and 4350. And in that, you'll see the comparison with the new Galaxy 9500 GT and even the S3 Graphics Chrome 440, which is, surprisingly enough, unabated the topic of one of our emails, as we'll get to later. But so the 9500 GT and the 4550 are about competitive in price, somewhat in the $60 to $70 range, and then the 4350 and the S3 Chrome 440 are in the same price range, probably closer to $50. And actually, the truth of the matter is the Chrome 440 is a little bit more expensive than that. It's more on the price range of the 4550 and 9500 GT because, as far as I can tell, the only place selling it is the S3graphics.com website and store. I couldn't find it on Newegg or anything like that. So you kind of miss out on some of that type of pricing and competition that you might normally see on the AMD and NVIDIA-based cards. All of the cards have their advantages and disadvantages. The 9500 GT is probably the better performer or the best performer of those and is reasonably priced. AMD kind of came back at me when I first got these RV10 based cards when NVIDIA dropped the price of the 9500 GT. They dropped it $30 or $40, 60, 70% when this happened, and AMD was basically saying, these are just rebates. They're not going to keep these price drops. So we think you should compare it to the 9400 or whatever it was at the time that was lower price. Well, since then, I've been watching the prices, and the 9500 GT has actually stabilized at the price where the mail-in rebates used to take it to. So it's still a fair competition, and the HD 5550s, or I'm sorry, 4550s are still kind of being released into the market. So we'll see how the prices kind of merge out there. This is another problem with this budget graphics area is, you know, we're supposed to kind of organize our discussions and organize our comparisons of this hardware based on its price. But you're talking about $6, $7, $8, $9, $10 price differences between these cards, and at what point does the granularity become too much to manage? You know, well, this card is an average of $8 more expensive than this one, or $12 more than this one. I think for the end user, $12 probably doesn't matter as much. Obviously, to an OEM, that can mean a world of difference. But so I guess the battle 9500 GT 4550, I lean towards the NVIDIA card as far as gaming performance goes. As far as efficiency and power consumption, the 4550 from AMD is the winner. It doesn't require any external power connections. Actually, I don't think the 9500 GT does either, now that I think about it. No, it doesn't. The 4350 is a great card for really, 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 really budget builds. The S3 Chrome, as you might guess, does not perform very well in our gaming tests. 3D Mark, World in Conflict, Crisis, Bioshock, that kind of stuff. It's always at the bottom. It runs, and it doesn't, you know, there's no artifacting. It's not a horrible experience. It's just, it's clearly a step below the AMD and NVIDIA cards in terms of gaming performance. So what they're pushing is HD video playback, Blu-ray, you know, decode acceleration, hardware acceleration, you know, the same. But unfortunately for S3, you know, this feature is also offered on all the AMD cards, all the NVIDIA cards at this point. It's a pretty universal feature now. Even the Intel G45 integrated chipset has it. So what are your thoughts on this budget area here?
Yeah, it's kind of insane to think that from $50 to $100, you've got SKUs that, you know, a year ago would have stretched between $75 and $200, yep. Which, you know, made it a lot easier on people who were reviewing crap. But right now, it's the stuff is just so compressed. It's like, you know, what kind of features and performance do I want? And is this extra $8 or $12 really worth it for this other card? And next thing you know, you're buying a $120 card. You were originally thinking of getting a $79.
Yeah.
And it's almost too much choice for consumers, because I think invariably they're gonna just keep looking around, and unless they set, you know, a really hard price point that they're not gonna go over, I mean they're just gonna keep going up and up and up, because like, hey, for a couple more bucks I can get this. Hey, for $8 more, I can get double the memory bandwidth. I mean, it's just kind of insane right now, and it's fabulous.
I feel like it's like the car buying experience. You know, you go in there and it's like, no, I'm going to get the base model of this. And you're like, well, you know, if you're
going to... for $200 more, you can get the full air conditioning and electric locks.
Yeah, and you just...
And since you bought that, we can throw in a deal where you get just this little extra feature and...
Clear coat!
Yeah!
But yeah, you're right. It's good for the consumer, but I think it's just as equally confusing for the consumer. I don't think Joe Sixpack, to use the great political terms that have come out, or Joe Plummer, exactly.
Yeah. Or even paid his taxes for a while.
Or even an enthusiast that's wanting to buy like a budget system or put together a budget system, really wants a 4350, a 4370, a 4550. A 4650, a 4670, a 4830, 4850, and 4870. You know, all those cards sit between, what, $50 and $200?
Or just a mite over.
Oh, yeah. 4870 is 250 now?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of SKUs. Obviously, AMD can address particular markets with these. You know, that's kind of what they're going after, I'm sure, is more of the OEM, ODM. You know, Dell wants to build a system at this price point where that $5, $6, $12 difference really matters to them. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, seeing it like it is now is confusing. We're gonna do our best to make it less confusing and try to offer up our opinions on just what to buy. And I don't think either any of us are afraid to say, suck it up, spend $10 more and get this card instead of this card. Because that's what people need to hear. And Joe Plummer should pay his taxes.
Yeah. I think that we cannot hammer enough on people that right now is just really, truly a second golden age of 3D graphics. I mean, kind of the first golden age was when we had NVIDIA come out with the Riva 128. We still had the Voodoo 1 graphics come out. The Voodoo 2 graphics had just come out. We're on the edge of TNT. We had Matrox and their G200 stuff. Rendition still was in the game with their 2200 series. It was just an amazing time.
SLI.
Yeah, it was just an amazing time to be a 3D graphics enthusiast. And right now, we are sitting in almost exactly the same thing, except even better. Because, I mean, you can now pick up a card for $79 that can do anything you really want it to at decent resolutions. And for $200, you can just go to town on most titles.
Yep. Agreed. I speaking of the golden age, the previous golden age, I got to tell you, one of my favorite parts of this S3 graphics card release came in the reviewer's guide. They give you this timeline of all of S3's product history, down to Vision, Trio, Verge, the Savage.
I remember
Super
the Verge.
Savage. Delta.
Oh, everybody remembers Verge.
I mean, they show some of these boxes of these old boxes. Stealth, you know, remember the Diamond Stealth brand, Viper 2. Oh, man, it brought back a lot of memories.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That was around the same time that Intel had bought up the Starfighter.
They did
and,
the
I-740. Released their I-740.
Yep.
And that was actually a pretty decent card at the time. It was a little bit slower than the rest. But we also had SIS, had actually a decent 3D graphics chip at the time. It was like the 6350 or something like that.
Yep.
It was just you know, an amazing and fun time if you were into 3D graphics.
So many different companies dipping their fingers into so many different products.
Oh, yeah. It was absolutely fabulous. And yeah, it was nice that at the time that S3, they released their Verge G series, GX, which actually brought their performance up so that it wasn't a 3D decelerator. And, you know, after that, then they had, the original 64-bit Savage. And, those were,
you know,
it was a lot of fun.
There's a statistic in this slide that I'm trying to figure out if it was good for S3 to put in here or if it's a little bit depressing. In 1996, S3 had over 50% of 3D market share. 3D graphics market share.
Really?
Yep.
Yeah, it was the first, you know, Verge DX and the Verge 3D.
So there you go. It's interesting. I should have an article up on this probably by the time you're hearing this, hopefully. Yeah, I kind of promised these guys that this review would be up this week, so I think so. We have other budget cards keep coming. I guess one of the things I'm curious to hear what you guys think and the listeners think. I'd be like to get some feedback on this. I ordered in a couple of Blu-ray HD DVD combo drives that we had all talked about on our Yammer sessions over there. For
those fabulous, wonderful drives that hopefully they keep producing for a long time.
So I bought a couple of those for the test beds because I had one Blu-ray drive. I was switching between everything, but I've been trying to, you know, I wanted to test Blu-ray playback on this, on all these graphics cards, because we tested it on G45, we tested it on the GeForce 9300 chipset that we'll talk about in a minute. My problem, all of these AMD, NVIDIA, Intel, and S3, all four companies have different versions of different software from different vendors that accelerate their hardware for Blu-ray decoding. Apparently, no publicly available piece of software will handle two, let alone all four. Which begs the question, why? You know, I mean, what's the holdup? I remember when Blu-ray decode was first coming out, you know, I expected to get a copy of PowerDVD from NVIDIA or AMD or WinDVD or whatever, because it was such a new technology, you know, we were going to get beta copies of this software, so to speak. But it's been a couple of years, and you can't go to PowerDVD or to CyberLink.com and buy a copy that accelerates all four. So do people care about that? I mean, who deserves the knock for that? The graphics card company or the software company?
Well, how many people will actually notice it, unfortunately?
Not many yet. Blu-ray's still
And so many people have, you know, fast dual core, and now we're starting to see, you know, a pretty significant chunk of quad core products out there that they get a version of PowerDVD, and it doesn't hook in to the AMD or the NVIDIA graphics or Intel or whoever.
Right.
But how many people are really going to look in there and say, hey, I see some strange Moore patterns that shouldn't be there, or holy crap, this is supposed to be a 3:2 pull-down film, and it's just, you know, it's not that way.
Yeah, I don't think many people would look at that, but I think more people would say, why is my CPU acting, why is my computer acting more sluggish than I had been told it was going to? You know, with a dual core system, it could actually make a difference. With a decent quad core system, like with my Q9300 that I used on the G45 motherboard, when hardware acceleration was not enabled, we were talking in the 30-40% CPU utilization, and that was with a very, very high bitrate H.264 encoded Blu-ray. Kind of the worst case scenario. And so, you know, 40% is not too bad. Now it's bad when you compare it to a GPU offloaded one that, you know, gets somewhere around the 10-12% range. Obviously, you know, especially power users want that extra flexibility with their system to do other stuff. But it seems so hokey and finicky. It reminds me of like getting physics technology in your computer. You know, you can use it for this one specific application, but it doesn't seem to be adopted widely enough and universally enough and easy enough for people to, you know, not have to look to see if it's actually working. I don't know. So
yeah.
It was just something I thought I'd bring up, because I spent much of my time today trying to find one application that would do all of it, and in my talks with all four companies, it doesn't exist. So
yeah, it's kind of sad, especially considering that it's, you know, we're coming on 9 months when Blu-ray has, you know, become the standard. Well, probably, you know, 10 months now.
Yeah. And it's declined in market share.
Yeah, how do you do that?
I laugh about it personally.
By being really annoying about
exactly
who gets to run it.
I mean, I had so many issues setting this up. I had my monitor going through a switch box, like a DVI switcher. HDCP doesn't follow through the switcher. So I couldn't run my movies any higher than 1280 by 768 until I disconnected from the switcher and plugged it in directly to the
graphics card. Or bought that really nice piece of software we really shouldn't talk about.
Yeah.
And the thing is, this is a really expensive dual-link DVI switch box that I just kind of assumed had that ability. And so the error I was getting for that wasn't that, hey, your HDCP isn't working. It was that you have an incompatible graphics card driver. That doesn't make any sense to me.
It means the same thing.
Yeah. that there were just there were tons of issues setting it up and getting it to work reliably. That I agree with Steve Jobs in that it is a bag of hurt, and I would be just fine if we will quickly move on to some form of downloadable HD media. I don't think it's going to be next year. I mean, some of these movies, the video stream is over 40, 45 megabits a second. So we don't have internet connections that fast yet. But
no.
So.
Well, we can blame a lot of this on Hollywood and what they've done to try to control their media. And, I can see where they're coming from. But at the same time, they've made, playback so labyrinthine that the average user is not going to take the time to get it to work right. Or, they have a monitor that's not HDCP.
VCR.
Yeah. But, sure, they slap in a drive, but they don't have an HDCP-compliant monitor, and they're playing something, and it down samples it, and they're like, why in the hell did I buy this? It doesn't look that much better than current DVDs that I have. Yeah, it's just, it's the industry kind of shooting themselves in the foot with trying to protect their content so much. And in fact, they've thrown so much money into this, but they're getting so little back that the price of piracy it now seems minuscule as compared to what they're actually doing to themselves.
Agreed.
Yeah.
So.
No argument here.
Okay, let's...
And so we'll expect a call from the MPAA's lawyer to your house here.
Well, and the RIAA, and...
See, here's the thing, is I'm one of my friends, I tell them to buy their music. I just buy all my music from Amazon's MP3 store that is 256 kilobit MP3 files with no DRM.
How much DRM is on it?
There's zero
DRM. Amazon, none.
Exactly.
And it's awesome. And I buy all my stuff through that. And I don't have any issues anymore. And it's $9.99, and it's, which I still think is overpriced for a CD when you're not getting anything, but,
I think some guy made a nice comic about that not too long ago.
All right, let's move on to something else that Steve Jobs mentioned besides that Blu-ray was a bag of hurt. Hey, did you guys know that the Apple MacBooks were going to get NVIDIA chipsets?
I hadn't heard that before today.
Well, someone had mentioned it, but I thought he might have been off his rocker.
Yeah, I think he was smoking some dope or
a lot of people said this guy was wrong, and here it was on October 14th, and there's a big screenshot of Steve Jobs next to an NVIDIA logo. Now,
so let me ask you this:
All right,
if I call you Cassandra, will you respond?
I don't know what that means.
Oh my God, you're such a heathen.
All right, were you going to explain to me?
Okay, Cassandra was, am I right, Jeremy? Cassandra was the seer in Troy who was cursed that she could see the future, but nobody would believe her.
Mm. Yep.
No, that's not me. I just pay attention to stuff as it goes on.
Oh, okay.
I never claimed to be psychic.
So anyway, Cassandra. So
the news was that Apple had an event. They released all new MacBooks and MacBook Pros, 13-inch MacBook, 15-inch MacBook Pro, and a slightly updated MacBook Air, all using NVIDIA's new mobility chipset for the Intel platform, now known as, used to be called MCP7A or 79A, can't remember, but now it is known as the GeForce 9400M GPU / chipset, whatever the hell they want to call it. So this means all these Apple MacBooks now get much, much improved graphics performance over the Intel GMA X3100 that they had before, and even better than the GMA X4500 that exists in the G45 chipset, which is the equivalent of what would be in Intel's Montavina chipset, which Apple skipped over in order to get this NVIDIA chipset. So what else do they get besides that? Most of it is this kind of far off in the future thing. I don't know if we've talked about OpenCL on the podcast before. It's a standard headed by Apple, but there are many people involved in it. And OpenCL is Open Compute Language. And you can think of it kind of, I guess, would we say it's a competitor to CUDA?
Yeah,
more or less.
Okay. So it's a compute language that will theoretically operate on processors, GPUs, and any other kind of processors that are created in the future. The point of it is to, you know, create a high-performance, highly parallelizable programming language and architecture so that we can begin to take advantage of processors like GPUs and like Larrabee when it comes up in 2010 or so. NVIDIA's GPU in the 9400GM chips or 9400M chipset supports CUDA and it supports OpenCL. Apple's behind OpenCL, so now all of their MacBooks will be able to support anything that they kind of promote with that. Makes sense. Apple's, you know, that kind of company. I also think that this means we'll see iMacs, Mac Pros, anything that Apple makes will eventually have, anything that Apple makes in the next through 2009, I'll say here, I think anything that Apple makes through 2009 will have an NVIDIA chipset in it or an NVIDIA graphics card in it. After that, then you've got competition from Larrabee, et cetera, et cetera. Also, we talked about H.264 decode acceleration. The GPU has support for that. Apple is one of the progenitors of H.264. They have no Blu-ray drives were added, but they offer H.264 downloads on their iTunes store and that kind of thing. One of the MacBook Pros, the 15-inch MacBook Pro, also includes a discrete 9600 GeForce 9600 GPU that kind of, I was a little disappointed. I actually just learned this today. It doesn't really support hybrid SLI. One of the cool things about hybrid SLI and hybrid power is hybrid SLI's ability to run both GPUs at the same time for improved performance. Apple's MacBooks don't support that. Hybrid power is the ability to turn off the discrete GPU and run purely off the integrated GPU or vice versa. And in Windows Vista, this is done on the fly. You don't have to reboot. You don't have to log out or anything like that. However, Apple apparently did not use NVIDIA's technology for this. They just use like a hardware mux, which is basically like an on-off switch type deal. Right, Josh?
Sure.
So they use a hardware mux that requires the user and software to have to log out of the machine and log back in order to switch between their GPUs, which in my opinion kind of ruins the effect. Yeah, there you go. So that's what they get out of it. Apple didn't really talk a whole lot about NVIDIA during the event. Steve Jobs didn't give them a whole lot of lip service, but it's still a big promotional benefit for NVIDIA. You know, they get a lot of street cred, so to speak, for being in Apple products.
Well, and not only that, but with the rumors flying around of them leaving the chipset business, you know, this just kind of flies in the face of all that, because the GeForce 9400 is a pretty significant piece of silicon. It's a single chip. It's got everything that they need. It's got the memory controllers, all the I/O stuff, USB. And a pretty solid and hefty integrated graphics that can be utilized for other things, such as the OpenCL.
Right.
You just kind of got to scratch your head and say, you know, here they just released this product. They just picked up a major win from Apple.
Mm-hmm.
Other wins are going to be coming down the road probably very quickly, because a lot of notebook manufacturers are really kind of tired of the performance that Intel gives in 3D graphics when, you know, they can get a Puma platform, and sure, it doesn't have all the little, you know, bells and whistles and a Core 2 Duo or Core 2 Quad in there,
right?
But it just outstrips it in terms of graphical performance. And while Vista hasn't, you know, taken off nearly as much as everybody has expected or Microsoft has wanted, it's still a significant portion that, the G45-based, graphics just isn't cutting it, and NVIDIA could take up a serious chunk of market share for integrated graphics for Intel processors with this. So,
So I've got to caveat this.
Let's hear it.
Well, Apple's not going to give them. Apple's chipset chipset business is good for NVIDIA. I don't know how good it is for their profit and bottom line. My guess is Apple got a sweetheart deal. They're getting it cheap because NVIDIA recognizes that the name and the marketing potential behind it is really just as valuable as cash in their pocket. Now, maybe in today's market, cash in your pocket would be better, but when they made this decision, my guess is that was not the case.
You know, I kind of disagree with that. I think that AMD had bailed out of the Intel chipset market, even though that they probably had a product that was very good, very competitive. I'm talking like a year ago. And, pretty soon Apple's just dealing with Intel. They're dealing with their integrated graphics. They're dealing with the Intel driver support, which for their integrated stuff has been horrific. And next thing you know, they get a knock on their door from NVIDIA saying, hey, we've got this, single chip. It's going to be 4 to 7 times faster than what Intel has. Not only that, but because we have our driver team behind it, it's going to pretty much run anything out there, even though you got to, chop down the quality.
Right.
They're going to say, hey, you can get all of this for 10% more per chipset than what you could get from Intel.
How much of a discount do you think they got once all the other...
Don't think that they probably got a discount, because if you look at the advantages of the NVIDIA chipset, I mean, they're significant. Single chip, much better performance, much better compatibility, and a driver team that actually pays attention to what the hell's going on.
Don't get me wrong. I completely see how that could have happened. And that might have been even the initial thing or the initial draw to it. But I think from a business standpoint, and as shrewd as Apple is with their business negotiations, it would be hard for them to ignore all the recent issues that NVIDIA has had with their products in ODM's machines.
True.
Right? And how do you assure a company like Apple that lives off of its name, that we promise this product will not come back and just bite you in the ass? And that, where I think, is maybe where they had to take a little bit of financial hit. Maybe not. It doesn't really matter in the end. But it's good news for NVIDIA. I just don't know how good news it is.
And yeah, true.
The product itself has been done for a while. Pretty much it's been done. And Apple said, we're going to use it. We want to be first. They got to announce it before NVIDIA was allowed to announce it. There's not a whole lot of companies that Apple would be able to push over like that, or vice versa, I mean. So it was interesting.
Yeah.
But it's good to see.
Well, I think we'll see in the numbers next quarter, at the end of Q4, which is what they announce in January or February.
Yep.
That we'll probably get a better idea of what's going on here. Will this be such a, a decent deal that NVIDIA is going to stay in the chipset? Or, was that a bunch of hot air? Or are they just saying, hey, you know what, this was nice for the time, but the amount of capital we're investing in chipsets versus, how much we're getting back, we feel that, we could apply that capital elsewhere and get better returns.
Yep. So we'll see. Depending on the fact that I'm recording this in Windows instead of a Mac OS, I might end up getting one. I was on MacBreak Weekly this week with Leo Laporte talking about this hardware change and how it affected these guys.
And, can I pet you?
No.
Okay, anyway.
But it was interesting because I was obviously the only dedicated Windows user on the panel of this discussion. And I defended the PC in many instances. I just want to go ahead and point that out. They were talking about Apple announced an $899 24-inch cinema display, and finally Apple was releasing a cinema display that was, a good value. And I promptly pointed out that Dell sells one with almost actually better specifications in terms of contrast ratio for like $619. And then if you want a crappy contrast eraser, you can get it for like $430. So you got to pay that Apple tax, so to speak.
Yeah.
This,
they look nice.
They do. Everything Apple makes usually looks nice. But let's segue into the actual product itself. I posted my article on the NVIDIA GeForce 9400/9300 chipset review, which is the desktop variant of this product that ended up in Apple MacBooks. So let me go over here to my whatchamahoozit page of it. And the specs compared to G45 are pretty much identical. You get the option of DDR2 or DDR3 memory, DDR2 800 or DDR3 1333. The front side bus support goes up to 1333. You get dual link, DVI, HDMI, DisplayPort output options. Obviously, all these features depend on the motherboard manufacturer's implementation. You also get the integrated GPU, the 9300 or 9400 GPU, the only difference of which is actually clock speeds of the core clock and shader clock. Six SATA ports, PCI Express 2.0, 16 lanes of that. Actually, 20 lanes total, but most likely we'll get one 16 lane for an external graphics card, 12 USB, gigabit Ethernet, HD audio, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So as far as the feature set goes, it's actually pretty robust. Nothing new that we haven't seen before, except with the exception of the integrated graphics in it and the all-in-one, as you already mentioned, Josh. It's a single chip, which is great for board design, you know, a lot less to work around. However, I have a beef because the first board I got was from MSI. Okay, it had a passive heatsink on the chipset.
Was it hotter than a snake's ass in a wagon rut?
It was. I measured it. I think the correct answer is yes to your question. I think, but I measured it with an IR thermometer at 210, 212 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's
toasty.
You know, I think, you know what it was? It was at 217 at one point, because I joked with my friend who was here that I was going to get a shot glass full of water and set it on the chipset until it started to boil.
Oil.
And oil would boil faster?
No, I said boil, not oil.
No, okay, boil, because I thought that would make a pretty good video. I might still do that, actually, now that I think about it.
Well, doesn't alcohol boil at a lower temperature?
Oh.
It do indeed.
I don't know. I'll look that up. I'll find something. I'll find some way to cheat. But, and when you take into account that the G45 Northbridge, which is also passive, now this is a little bit disconcerting because the G45 has a Northbridge and a Southbridge still. But the Northbridge has the memory controller, the graphics, the PCI Express 2.0. So it has the majority of what I consider would be the hot items in it. And it never got above 100 degrees Fahrenheit. The ASUS motherboard that I tested also had a passive heatsink, and it got to 190 degrees Fahrenheit, something like that. So it's not specific to MSI's board. Obviously, ASUS did a little bit better job, but it's still a very, very hot chip. So
yeah, that's getting awful close to that 105°C temperature that supposedly these are good till.
If the surface temperature of the heatsink is 210 degrees, what do you think the temperature is on the GPU? Is it less or higher than that?
It's got to be higher.
Yeah, see, that's bad.
A little bit.
That's bad. Okay.
Okay.
So other than that, like we went through the features, the graphics architecture on it. If for those people that want to know the numbers, it has 16 shader processors. 54 gigaflops of processing power.
Is it 16 or 32? I can't remember.
16 okay. Shaders. The 9300 version runs at 450 megahertz core, 1200 megahertz shader. And then the 9400 version, the GeForce 9400 chipset, runs at 580 megahertz core, 1400 megahertz shader. What's interesting, and I think, I try to put these little puzzle pieces together, relates to all the motherboards I got three. Zotac, MSI, ASUS.
Yeah.
All of them were 9300 chipset. And there's apparently only one 9400 that exists from Gigabyte, and I didn't get that one. If I were to make a conspiracy theory out of this, I would look at the heat levels that I saw and then adding another 130 megahertz core and 200 megahertz shader clock to that and see what you get.
Heatsink melting its way off of the processor.
Right. All the motherboards were good as far as layouts go. They're all pretty much the same as you might expect. The only one that really stood out to me was the ASUS board because of its connectivity options. It had, for video output, it has VGA, DVI, DisplayPort, and HDMI, all on the back panel.
Ooh.
Which is pretty cool. 6 USB, 1 eSATA optical audio output, gigabit.
And you could use a double-spaced video card in there without blocking any of the SATA ports.
Yes, another benefit.
That MSI card would not do that.
No. You know, I do have it's just one of these pet peeves with me. NVIDIA says that the chipset supports dual-link output, so up to resolutions of 2560 by 1600, but all three motherboards that I got in only supported single-link output, so you were limited to 1920 by 1200. Why? NVIDIA would not answer me why. Why would, if that's the case, if it can support higher, why would ASUS, MSI, Zotac, Gigabyte, all these companies decide to do single link? Is it because the cost of...
Because the extra cost of... Well, I mean, there's, Silicon Image builds the majority of those chips that do the links, and that it's a digital link from the chipset graphics to this decoder, transcoder, whatever you want to call it, from Silicon Link. And it's like 30% more expensive than the single link. And so when you're talking a motherboard that 99% of the users aren't going to go over 1600 by 1200, what's the point in adding all that cost?
What's the cost difference?
Well, I'm just throwing numbers out in the air. But
well, yeah.
It's probably, I would say, a 30% difference in cost by chip.
I don't know. I guess, and especially if you're using these for home theater PCs where 1080p is kind of the max resolution you're hitting right now, I guess it makes sense. It's just annoying.
Yeah.
Real quick, benchmarks. As you would expect, chipsets are pretty kind of even keel, even Steven, so to speak. The only downfall is NVIDIA's memory controller is definitely lagging behind Intel's on this. The Sandra 2009 memory test, it's a difference of 5,200 megabytes per second versus 5,700 megabytes a second. So it's 10%, fairly noticeable. And that result pokes its head up, not in any of the CPU real heavy benchmarks, obviously, as you'd expect, but when you get into PC Mark Vantage tests what did they use them for? Like the video editing, the TV, the image editing, that kind of stuff. You could see slight differences in performance. Not a huge amount. But I think that the gaming performance benefit you get with it is obviously outweighs that. For example, at 1024 by 768 in Crysis, the difference in the GPU test was 17 frames a second on the Intel system and 31 frames a second on the NVIDIA system. So almost double.
And obviously, how does the Intel system look?
It actually didn't look bad. Actually, NVIDIA often does that. They put out their slides and they point out what the difference is between, you know, running Second Life on NVIDIA and Second Life on Intel. I've never tried to verify the screenshots because I would spend the rest of my life verifying BS that PR departments put out if I wanted to do that. But I sat there and I watched these go through and there might have been a little bit of difference, but nothing as dramatic as always shows up in these demos and shots. World in Conflict was the fog, not the fog, the smoke was a little bit different, but we got 5 frames a second on the Intel system and 28 on the NVIDIA system. Not even really a comparison at this point. Overclocking sucks on the GeForce 9300 chipset. Or as NVIDIA wants you to call it, the GeForce 9300 motherboard GPU, which I won't call it. But you're reaching 1500 megahertz front side bus was pretty much the limit. And that took a lot of work. the MSI motherboard barely reached 1400 megahertz frontside bus, even with voltage adjustments and that kind of thing. So again, I think this might come down to a little bit of the thermal issue. I don't know. So that's my thoughts.
Have they mentioned what process this is made on?
No. I would guess 65.
Yeah, I would too.
I don't have a die size. I have a picture of the chip next to a quarter, though.
Ooh.
I don't think that's going to help.
Canadian or American?
It's interesting. If you look at the picture of the die shot, it says GF 9300 730i B2. And if you'll notice in my discussion, the term 730i never came up. That was the original name for the chipset, the NVIDIA 730 or the Inforce 730i, but they went away with that. So all these motherboards you can get for under $130. The ASUS is going to retail for $129, the MSI $110, and the Zotac for $99. So you get it's a good amount of technology for the price. And considering you could buy this motherboard, the processor I used on here, I think is going to cost you more than that. The Q9300, which is a quad-core 2.5 gigahertz processor, is going to run you $250. So even it might be a little bit of overkill for this product line. But so you're at under $400 in a really, really good system that's almost ready to go. Get a hard drive, an optical drive, and there you go.
Memory.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You might need some of that.
Yeah.
But
power supply.
Audio integrated, video integrated, networking integrated, all that good stuff. And you can build a pretty good, pretty cheap system. So,
and you can play WoW.
You can play WoW. I know Josh loves it. All right, let's talk today. Josh, I know you're really excited. You like to talk about money that people lose.
I like money.
Particularly AMD's. But
I don't like losing AMD's money, but sort of.
Apparently they lost money this quarter, but it's a good thing.
Yeah, because, you know, 2 quarters ago they had lost something like, 1.3 billion? And, you know, while that, you know, was not actual monetary money.
Most of that
was just value in the company. And so while they have lost money, it was not nearly as much as many were expecting, including myself. I was expecting another $300 million type loss quarter.
Right.
And when you talk to Wall Street, they were, you know, expecting kind of around that thing, you know, about 40 cents per share loss, which would have come in between, you know, 300 and 400 million in the hole. Well, AMD came out and what?
I said sweet.
Yeah. Well, AMD came out and said, hey, we only lost, you know, when you consider, you know, generally accepted accounting practices, that we've lost minus, you know, 67 million.
Does that bother you when they say, if you take into account generally accepted accounting practices?
Well, you know, you got to look at the non-GAAP and the GAAP, and it's just...
It's too complicated for me.
It's annoying. But in ways...
Anyway.
But it's a drop in the bucket as compared to what AMD has done previously. And when you add in some of the other things that, you know, some of that minus 67 million was actually just value in company and losses on areas that they have, you know, sold off and gotten rid of, excuse me, and divested themselves in. They're actually looking
the
pretty good from a
new investment from Abu Dhabi.
They didn't mention anything about that. There's been no new cash influx from any other, you know, kind of third parties who are just investing in the company. Their biggest deal was licensing of technology and the sale of fabrication machinery to some Russian company. And this is like, I think this is the 130 nanometer type node products that they've sold off to these companies, and as well as their IP for, you know, how to make chips on these machines. That it accounted for something like $191 million just in itself. And while the licensing fees are going to be lower in the next several quarters, it's still going to be a significant amount of income. Where AMD has really seen some growth is in their, you know, CPUs, graphics, and chipsets. The graphics has increased in revenue 55% over the past quarter, which is pretty astounding. But when you take a look at exactly what the products are, it's not so surprising. I mean, the 4800 series has just taken off. The 4600 series has really just redefined price performance for that that segment, and they're doing well. Their chipsets are doing very well. They started out last year with the 700 series, you know, the 770, the 790.
Mm-hmm.
They gained you know, some momentum. The 780 was introduced in late winter, early spring. That again hit its stride. The 740 has been, you know, popular at the very, very low end. And now we've got the 790 GX and all that, and so I mean their chipsets are doing very, very well. The CPUs, now that they got you know, back in spring when they started releasing the B3 revisions, they started to sell some significant numbers of quad cores. People like the 9900 and the 9800s, especially considering their current price point, which is what, 159 to 169. When you consider that each, you know, die probably cost them about $80 for a quad core to actually produce, I mean they're getting some, you know, still decent margins on there to keep themselves above, you know, above ground. And so AMD has certainly turned their stuff around in the past year. I mean, especially considering what we were dealing with you know, the original Barcelona and B2 cores, the problems they're having, the amounts of power that it was sucking, you know, the HD 2900 was just kind of the bastard child of the graphics industry. Mm-hmm. Nobody liked it very much.
And
arguably with the 3800 series, they just started kind of changing things around. And this past year, they've really steamrolled. And, you know, they're maybe by the end of this year, they'll actually see, you know, without splitting themselves up quite yet, you know, they may see a small profit. It's coming into the holiday season.
Hot damn.
They've got good products. We're going to see a couple of new products coming up in the next couple of months. They're ramping up their 45 nanometer stuff. In fact, I think that their 45 nanometer stuff is the production samples are being sent to some of their primary suppliers, well, OEMs, server builders, and so that's going to be, you know, money in the bank for AMD. So things are looking up for them. It's Q3. It's typically a strong season for them. Q4 is going to be stronger. About the only thing that's really been a stumbling block for them is that their Puma platform probably has not taken off nearly as much as they were expecting.
Second that.
Yeah, and you know, a big part of that is probably the Montevina platform from Intel.
It's really hurt. That,
yeah, it has, and certainly the graphics portion is superior, but, you know, when you package the entire thing together, you know, a lot of people are just staying with Intel.
Yep. All right. So, okay, that's a pretty good amount of technology discussion, news, what have you. This time I want to get into a handful of listener emails. No voicemails. By the way, you can still do this, of course.
Well, I sent you a voicemail, but you really can't play that.
I deleted
on
that.
The internet.
No. The phone number, 1-888-38-PC-PER. Call and leave us a question, a comment. You can make fun of Josh if you want. You can also email all of the above to podcast@pcper.com. Please tell us your name, where you're from, how awesome the podcast is. That will always help get the email on the list here. So I'll start.
Hey, you know what? You can make fun of Jeremy. He has the funny accent.
Yeah, it's from Canada.
Oy. He's Canadian. Oh, Canada.
Can you believe Canada had, they had Thanksgiving, like, last week?
Yeah, Canadian Thanksgiving. Great.
That's weird.
Okay, here's something that just kind of blows me away, literally, is that you guys have got some internal terrorism going on there with people blowing up natural gas pipelines up north.
Well, not really, but kind of.
What do you mean, kind of? Either you blow up a natural gas pipeline or you don't.
Well, and yes, I suppose they did.
All right, no.
Radical Canadians. Sort of... I mean, you know, how much of a step away from reality is that?
Well, they don't have guns, so they got to think of something.
Well, I mean, you drink enough beer and everything sounds like a good idea.
Agreed. All right, I don't like getting into a political discussion. I'm going to read this email now.
Okay.
First one from Anthony, also known as MadHatter256 in our forums. Hey guys, loving the podcast. See how that helped get him in on the show.
You have such a silky smooth voice, Ryan. I just want to meet you in person and
You deleted that email.
I deleted that portion of it. Anyway, I have a couple of questions. One, about SSDs. Do you see the need for defragging hard drives dying out with the new SSD? I remember it was essential to defrag after installing large files on a PC, especially back in Windows 98 days. I think the answer is no. In fact, I'm pretty sure in my discussions with Intel, this has come up. In fact, the controller on solid-state drives purposefully breaks up the files and randomizes the locations where it reads and writes data on the surface of the memories, on the drive in order to equalize wear across the entire disk. So I think simply because of that, defragmenting will be a thing of the past.
That's kind of nice. I was going to go the other way, but you know, now that you say that, it certainly has the ring of truth about it.
Well, you know, I try. I'm glad I got my answer in before you lied to everybody, though.
Exactly, because, you know, it's always embarrassing to be saying, now, Josh, I talked to Intel about this, and you're wrong. Not only you're wrong, but you're really, really wrong.
All right. The second part, about AMD and Intel, would you agree that putting graphics and other components into a CPU could be overkill and potentially kill the diversity of the PC hardware market? If things continue, all we will have to buy is just the motherboard and CPU, because maybe they might start putting the motherboard on the CPU. They actually already do that in some low-end products. Look at VIA's CPUs.
Yep.
Why would I pay $400 or so for a CPU with good graphics, and then 5 months later, a faster one comes out? He mentions in here CPU sockets changing, all this other kind of stuff too. So I guess the answer to this is you're right, and that it does potentially kill some of the diversity in the PC market. However, the only place I think it will kill it will be in the
low end,
right? Low power, low cost, obviously
netbook type market.
Yeah. And so this is, you know, we saw integrated graphics on the chipset. Putting on the CPU is going to have its advantages. It's going to have its disadvantages, as we'll see coming into 2009 and 2010. But I don't think you're not gonna see the GTX 280 or even AMD put their 5870 on a CPU. It just doesn't make any sense. Well, I'm talking about the next generation.
Oh, next generation.
You know, you're not gonna see 5870 or 6870 come out on paired with a Phenom X16 or whatever, because those parts are going to be too large of their own accord to be put together onto a single die. The complexities
and
of building a new GPU.
Power.
Right.
Yep. Power and heat.
Exactly.
Huge.
So, no. Okay, I think the answer is
required.
No. Yeah. You have to live in Canada and leave the computer outside.
Hey, ducting works up here.
Yeah, well, there you go. Okay, so I think we've answered the majority of his questions. Anthony had a lot. We appreciate it. Well, send us, if we didn't answer anything that you meant to for us to answer, Anthony, just write me in again and we'll get it back in there. Let's see. Jeremy, why don't you read our next email here from Jordan from question mark?
Well, Jordan from possibly Jordan.
Could be.
Who knows? says, just wondering what you thought about the best graphics card solution for the upcoming Adobe CS4. Will a simple 8800 GT suffice, or will a higher-end card make a significant performance increase, especially when they employ Pixel Bender, or use the GPU to generate filters in the future? The reason he asks, because it seems to me, as a graphic designer, for the next year or so, I can get way better performance from a PC over an Apple using a higher-end GPU than Apple offers. This may compensate for whatever performance increases there is using OS X, which seems much faster than Vista. So does the Turtle, but... last question, do ATI products work with Adobe CS4 or only NVIDIA? Thanks a lot. Keep up the good work. And for some reason, he listens every week.
this is a really good series of questions. And we may have answered a couple of them already as we discuss. So the best graphics card for Adobe CS4. Anything that supports
CUDA. Almost as much as CS4.
Yeah. Anything that supports CUDA should run Adobe CS4 just fine. A higher-end card may add some performance, but my guess would be it will not be a significant performance gain, especially if we're talking specifically about the enhancements that Adobe CS4 sees, because in Adobe CS4, we're only talking about zooming, panning, those types of thing. Any 9 series, I would guess, would be pretty acceptable for that.
Yeah.
But wasn't there an announcement today about the Quadro?
There is now
more optimized?
The best graphics card.
We're talking about the Quadro that was that was discussed today.
Yeah, the Quadro CX.
Right. That's what I was going to say. He talks about when they employ Pixel Bender, which is going to be an add-on for Adobe that does a lot more of effects than just panning and zooming and increasing the speed of those. Now, what I have been told and what is kind of, you know, discussed, or maybe not discussed, but, you know, has been determined based on this announcement that NVIDIA made about this new Quadro card, is that the really high-end effects in the Adobe software for Photoshop and what I think is more important is for Premiere, for video editing, encoding, that kind of deal, will be limited to Quadro cards, and maybe even specifically this series of Quadro cards that was just announced. Now, my problem with this is that it's a completely invented reason by NVIDIA, right? Quadro cards do not differ greatly from GeForce cards. This has been the case for many, many years. You might get more memory. You know, we've had 2 GB Quadro cards out for quite some time because CAD users can take advantage of that much memory, whereas games can usually not. The GPU technology is usually almost exactly the same, if not exactly the same, running at similar clock speeds. So the fact that NVIDIA would take these technologies and restrict them to Quadro users makes sense to them from a business standpoint. People who run Adobe CS4 software, as we discussed last week, probably have a lot of money. At least if they're bought a legal copy of Adobe CS4, you know, the whole suite of stuff. You know, if they're going to spend $2,400 on a piece of software, then spending $1,000, $2,000 on one of these Quadro cards, you know, they can still write it.
$19.99.
$19.99?
Yep.
There you go. So that's the reason they're doing it. It's completely from a business standpoint. It's aggravating to me, though, because we have been told by NVIDIA over and over again how great GPGPU is going to be and how great CUDA is going to be and how the future of computing is with these highly parallel processors like their GPUs. And so they tell us this, they tell enthusiasts this, and then they say, yeah, you don't get that feature, though. We decided that you need to spend way more than $250 in order to run Adobe fast. But enjoy Crysis.
People play that?
No, actually, I was just kidding. No. That's my opinion. Disagree, agree, don't care.
No, No, I agree. I mean, they're just trying to monetize this, and you know, they're going to offer these heavy-duty features at a higher price, and the people who really need them will actually have the money set aside to be able to buy this. I mean, the corporations, the companies, the, you know, the big pigs on Wall Street.
Right.
Okay, maybe not them, but, you know, the average user, you're not going to pay that extra amount for 5% more productivity.
No.
No.
All right, and your last part here, you talk about get away with better performance from a PC over an Apple by using a higher-end GPU than Apple offers. If you're using a Mac Pro for the day, that might be true. However, as we discussed just a little bit ago, and as you probably know since this happened after you wrote in the email, Apple announced their MacBooks with NVIDIA chipsets in it, so they will get the benefit of this software, even on those integrated GPUs. So, you know, take what you want out of that. If you're used to Macs, you may still want to go with Mac on that and see what your performance is like. But keep in mind that this is still very limited in what software actually supports it right now. And I have been trying every day to get my hands on some of this software and some of this hardware to actually do test and see what people will benefit from it. So, Josh, you want to take your email?
Jeff from SoCal. Nabokov Fam 87.
Did you mind what Nabokov is?
Yeah, Evgeny Nabokov. He's a goalie.
Okay.
And since I'm a Colorado Avalanche fan, I'm
that's why really I picked this email for you. That's why I picked about, this email for you, actually, yeah.
Taking about better. This.
Anyway, well, I'll deal with it. Hey, show. I have a pretty old computer by most standards. I built it back in July of 2005, and it was my first build. Basically, I learned mountains of knowledge since then, and am anxiously awaiting the build of my second ring. But I just don't have the funds to do so. In some games, my PC is starting to chug, mostly in Half-Life 2, when there are a lot of physics and such happening. Here are my specs. Custom build.
We probably don't have to read all of these, but it's a...
Athlon 64 4000, 2 gigs of memory, hard drive.
Reread that. It's 2 gigabytes.
Radeon X800 XL, which is, you know, still a decent card for the time.
Well, yeah. Rest of it looks
now good. That all that info is out of the way, onto my question. Some of the games, looking onward, are requiring the Vertex Pixel Shaders 3.0 while my video card supports version 2. Isn't it, what, 2.0B? Or is it 2.0A? Anyway.
It was DirectX 9C. Anyway.
The X800 XLs were based on the original, which were 2.0A, which was 9.0B. Anyway, taking into account the fact that I still have a single-core CPU and I'm having the issues with physics and games, should I buy a $50 card, video card now and just suck it up and wait for the whole new rig? Also, my MOBO is PCIe by 16 slots, but not version 2. What's the difference? Will a 2.0 card work?
All right, there you
go. Well, I would say that if you've got PCI Express, you should go buy a 4670 or one of the new 4830s that's coming out NDA soon and see what that gets you, because a 2.4 gigahertz Athlon processor is still not a slouch. It may affect you in some of these multi-threaded games that are, you know, becoming more common. But still, it shouldn't be a big deal. I think, you know, your biggest problem is probably your video card out of that system. You got plenty of memory. Your hard drive's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Your processor's still pretty fast, even though it's, you know, it's only a single core. But in most games, that shouldn't make a big difference. I think where the wall you're hitting on is your video card, and spending $80 to $100, $120 would be a very good investment for you right now, and you would see some really big returns from that.
Well, yeah, I think you'd be able to. There's a really good choice in cheap PCI Express video cards right now.
You know, oddly enough, I think there is. Now, even though you have the original PCI Express 1.0, it's still going to work with all of these PCIX 2.0 cards. It's not going to be a problem. You're not going to notice a single issue with it. Just plug it in. As long as you have a power supply that can power the video card, you're going to be good.
Can't argue with that. Well, I could, but it'd be wrong.
Well, okay.
Okay, Jeremy, why don't you take this last one?
GruvoNet.
Sounds right to me.
Hi, everyone. Exclamation point.
Yes, but only one. Thanks for doing this podcast. I never miss one episode. I'm a 3D graphics performer from France working in the UK. I play a lot of OpenGL, but with the OpenGL 3 story, I decided to use more Direct3D. I really like the reviews, but there's one chip seem to miss. The S3 Chrome 430 and the 440. Why didn't you do a full review? It's maybe not a very powerful chip, but as far as you did a review on the GeForce 9300 and the 9400, why not? A friend told me that their OpenGL support is really good, a lot better than the ATI one, at least in terms of features. I just want to know a bit more about this chip and its architecture. Would it be possible in the review to have detail about the features supported by the hardware and also by the software? Just to let people know. As a 3D graphics programmer, what can you expect to do with these chips? What do you got on compression formats, OpenGL extensions, development tools updates? Sort of like the Radeon Tessellator story. The issue is not that one uses it, it's that ATI doesn't provide anything to use it with.
All right. Thank you for the email. There's obviously a little bit of typos there. Kind of messed things up. So the basis of his question is, hey, what about the S3 Chrome 440? And we kind of already discussed it. It will be in an article that will be up probably by the time you hear this on the site that looks at GPUs under $70. I think, ironically enough, though, now that I think about it, there were no OpenGL tests that I ran. OpenGL for gaming, at least, is not... It's just not used by anything anymore. I think Quake Wars is pretty much the last game that has come out using OpenGL, right?
Is that even using OpenGL now? Well, I guess it is.
It's based off Doom 3 engine, right?
Yeah, it's Prey, but I mean they did a lot of work to get that into Direct3D, so that
you're right. You
they
might
could use that on Xboxes, but you know I do think that it is an OpenGL title still.
So, but even id will be moving to Direct3D with Rage and all this other kind of stuff. So we don't do a lot of OpenGL testing here anymore. The results might be a little disappointing. When the review goes up, you'll see a little bit about the architecture of the S3 Chrome 440 and what it can offer, and you'll get to see a little bit of what kind of performance it can offer when you look at the synthetic tests in 3D Mark Vantage and 3D Mark 06 and that kind of stuff. So that should definitely help you with it, and you'll get to see how it compares to AMD and NVIDIA. I would still lean towards one of the other two manufacturers. Probably NVIDIA is better known for its OpenGL support than ATI.
Yeah. Correct.
Yeah. So, you know, and with that, you're going to get, I hate to be a downer on the small guy, but you're going to get the benefit of more frequent driver updates, better support when new software comes out, especially when it's for professionals and this kind of stuff. I think for professional 3D graphics, OpenGL, I would look towards some of these low-cost NVIDIA cards too. So, but you'll be able to read about the S3 Chrome in just a little bit.
And I think, you know, something else that probably needs to be added to this is that, while the idea of OpenGL is very, very good, changes in the implementation take a very long time. And when we're looking at guys like Microsoft to control Direct3D, they can implement changes relatively quickly as compared. They don't have to go through big conferences. They don't have to run these specs by 24 different members. and have each one review them and, you know, make their own little suggestions and either say, yeah, this is great, or no, this needs more work. And, you know, unfortunately, I like the idea of OpenGL, but since there's not one single entity that's really pushing it, I mean, 5 years ago, well, probably, yeah, about 5 years ago, I mean, we really think about what was going on with the Quake engine. I mean, you know, a lot of the game titles were using OpenGL. I mean, a lot of the big ones, like Medal of Honor, Call of Duty, you know, a lot of other products out there that were using that. But now we've gotten to the point, because OpenGL has just kind of lagged behind Direct3D and what they're able to do with the hardware that's coming up, and the support, you know, now what's the only title that we can think of that uses OpenGL, and that's Quake Wars or yep. Prey. And there's nothing new coming out, and Rage is going to be Direct3D. And so, unfortunately, you're kind of hitting a wall there.
Yep.
And it's sad, because OpenGL is a wonderful thing, but it just couldn't keep up in terms of development.
Oh, well. Well, I guess there's nothing else. I'm not going to anything.
Wipe that tear from your eye, Ryan.
I will miss GL Quake. That's for sure. Thank you for the emails, everybody. Thank you for listening to the show. I think that pretty much wraps us up. We ran a little long again, as we always do. Sorry, made everybody listen to us. If you want to contact the show, send us an email, podcast@pcper.com, or leave us a voicemail, 1-888-38-PCPER, and you can get on the show and brag to all your friends about it. I know you want to. So, good show, everybody. Right?
It's been a business doing pleasure with you.
Yeah. Nothing from Jeremy. All right.
Well, I can think of worse ways to spend an evening.
But not many.
Well, depends on how much detail you want me to go into.
That's not. Okay, so with that, I'm Ryan Trout.
I'm Jeremy Holstrom.
And I'm Josh White.
Thanks for listening.